everybody. How are you today? I hope the world is treating you extra special. I hope you're pleasantly neato. And if not, oh man, we have a tremendously fun episode ahead of us. I feel like I'm doing the SNL thing. Like, we have a great show before the studio's even seen it. It's always a weird thing to say out loud. But we are catching up with a friend of the site, a composer of great expertise and phenomenal hair, Will Bates from Fall on Your Sword, and pretty much so many other things you may know, may not know, but his music will definitely hit you where it hurts, make you remember him, and he's welcome back any time of the year. So, Will, it's so good to see you again. It's basically 4 years by our count before we hit record. How are things in your world?
I think so. Everything in my world is pretty good. It's been a while. Thank you for having me back. Thank you for the phenomenal intro. I feel like the hair's taken a beating lately, but that's pretty kind.
You know, I was talking with my wife a number of times, you know, where everybody laments on the idea of getting old. And you always look at people like George Clooney and Cary Grant. And, you know, time catches up with us. And no matter how great you look, how great your hair is, pretty much we're all going to be wrinkled raisins one day. So live in the now, make hay while the sun shines, and enjoy Will Bates's sensational music. Man, it is so good to see you again. You know, let's just jump to your right. Saxophone, scale of one to ten. What would you rank yourself?
A very proud six. Is that all right? Yeah. I don't. It looks as if I've staged that, but I'm in the middle of a job, so that's why that's sitting there. The saxophone is normally the first thing that gets removed from the score, as my wife continuously reminds me. I started out as a sax player, and I'm constantly trying to Trojan horse horns into a score. And I have a feeling Ben Stiller might have also he might have joined the ranks of people who said, like, oh, I love this cue, get rid of that popping sound. But every now and again, a director comes along who lets me keep the horns in. So I'm on one right now that I'm hoping he will allow it, let's say. So.
You know, since I'm in a creative industry myself, I always have like a little basket of tricks, things I want to try, and I always wait for that phrase, now is the time. You know,
yes, there you go. Exactly.
You hold on to it, you hurdle it, you hoard it, so to speak, and then, you know,
Indeed.
Give it to the world. But, you know, I commend you. You know, a six is pretty honest. You know, if you're not bleeding gums, Murphy, it's not the bad thing. At least you're not making people's gums bleed from the power of your music.
There you go. So that's right. I think I could have been an eight at one point in my life, but I thought I was going to be Cannibal Adderley when I grew up, and then I got to about 20 or 21 and realized that I didn't quite have the staying power for it. So the techno kind of sunk its claws in, let's say.
Well, even if you never match Cannonball's legendary fingers and skill at the mouth, which sounds like a weird thing to say, he's inspired generations. One of my favorite jazz musicians is Jasmine Mira from the UK, and she was very taken by Cannonball and Lisa Simpson, funny enough.
Yep,
her foray.
I get that. She's very inspiring.
But let's turn this back to you, Will Bates. Let's talk about Stiller and Mira, Nothing Is Lost. Man, I'd like to think this is great praise, great compliment. Your soundtrack, your score, actually, whether you're watching to picture or not, makes it feel like you're flipping through photo albums, going through nostalgia. There are some sounds that I can't quite make out. I'm not even sure they're instruments. Can you talk about what the first step is to something like this? You know, forget picture, forget director. When something says nostalgia to you, like, how do you, you know, what does that conjure in your mind?
Totally. That's a great question. I feel like that was the first thing that Ben and I talked about when we started to get into this. This notion of memory and reminiscence without being sentimental, which is a real knife edge, you know. And I think for me that kind of meant melody. And we talked about like there being melody that as another director once said to me quite recently, if an audience gets to the end of the movie and feels like they own the melody that you've planted in the beginning, then you've won. And I think that's a lovely way of putting it. It's like if you can kind of plant the seeds of melody early on and then use that melody to alter context and, you know, change experience. I think that was kind of the goal with this at the beginning. And really I think in the end it was just like a light touch. You know, I sometimes would find myself having to kind of pull back quite a bit and not saying too much. I tend to write a lot at one go and like make big gestures and present things with tons of layers. And then I find myself taking a sledgehammer to those ideas and kind of peeling them back to their rawest form. And that was definitely the case with this, that simplicity was sort of was the key. Everything just seemed to work once we found that melody and could explore themes that way.
And coming from a director, writer, actor, I mean, this is his story, his family. I mean, I guess it doesn't get more personal than this.
Totally.
Did you get, not in a mean sense or bad sense, but like, did you get pulled down into the weeds too? I mean, like, how do you stay surface level on something that exactly like you said, you didn't want to be too heavy or on the nose with?
Sure. I think what was so lovely about this is that I came on relatively early, and Ben still, there was an assembly that I watched, but they were still trying to figure out what the story was. And the first cut that I watched was it was beautiful and still, very much has the DNA of what the finished thing is. But it was more of a kind of linear story about their lives. And I think as Ben was kind of working it through, he started to realize that it's also a meditation on growing up with famous parents, like, and he involved his own children. And suddenly there was like an interesting mirror with his mom and dad and his kids, and it became even more personal. And I think that being involved early allowed me to sort of be part of that journey and start to kind of understand together like what this is really about. And I, like some of the earlier themes that I wrote were more dense, I guess, and kind of had like more propulsion and movement. And then like the more we kind of understood what the journey this was going to be was, I found myself, yeah, just kind of peeling back those layers. So yeah, I think, I mean, the fact that it was so personal, again, like really spoke to needing this kind of strong, identifiable melody that we can kind of carry the audience along with and return to. And, I think that's really what Ben was looking for.
And also too, the thing I'm, if I was to imagine myself in Ben's shoes or maybe even your shoes, you're trying to put two things together, which is tale's old as time. You're trying to take picture and sound in a way that's cohesive. And I think one of the difficult things in my mind is that if I were trying to cobble something together, memories, there's no rule book. There's no sort of you think of maybe a composer who writes a suite after reading a script and it's like 16 minutes of music, and that may work with an assembly cut, that may work with one version of the film, but then when you start chopping it up or you have a, I imagine that it might be easier to mix up picture than it would sound. So I guess how do you face that where it's like, man, these 8 bars were so good, but now if I have to cut it to in half, does it
Totally.
lose its mystique? Like,
It's
what's that
funny.
process?
It's like I have a violinist I work with a lot called Lev Liova Zurbin, and he always talks about music that's been measured with a tape measure instead of bar numbers. And it's kind of like it's a good analogy of like what happens sometimes when editors take your stuff and just kind of snip it to picture and not necessarily musically. I will say with this, another great reason why being involved earlier was so helpful. I did, in fact, make sketches, and I scored probably the first 20 minutes of the cut the way that it was months and months ago. And the editors, Adam and Jeff, were like, do you think you could give us the stems of those pieces? And we really love these melodies, and if you're okay with it. And I'm like, of course, I'm very like not precious about that kind of stuff. So I split out a lot of those cues. I think there are about 10 or 15 cues that they had all the individual instruments for, and it meant that they could really kind of use the music to dictate their cut and vice versa. And it was, rudimentary editing, and like they would take a stem that was kind of atmospheric and maybe like overly simplistic and then add it to some other piano thing that I'd done. And then eventually give it back to me, be like, this is kind of what we're thinking. Obviously it's a bit rough, but could you use that as a springboard? And that was a really helpful, it kind of jumped a whole like other series of decision making, like I could tell that this is what they wanted to do and understood what the solution would be to make it more elegant. And that was, yeah, that was great. So it was sort of bypassed what you're talking about of that, like, how am I going to get this bar of seven in now that the, yeah, I've, that's kind of, there are so many little tricks that we all pick up along the way as well as composers to kind of make you think that there's consistent rhythm when in fact we're going through all sorts of crazy time signatures to picture. But yeah, there really wasn't that much of that in this case because they were really cutting a lot of the sequences, the bigger ones at least, but they were cutting to my music, which is awesome.
And I think it takes a lot of strength to put something about your family out there. I mean, Stiller, it's a legendary family, has lore in entertainment. But I think that, looking behind the curtain is difficult. I mean, I think one of the most amazing bits of monologue or a quote from the film is the need for success is as much a creative expression as it was security for his family. And I just think that, first of all, just existing in the world, whether, with something so that a safety net like entertainment is difficult to go into, same like music, but like ha having to walk that line must have been difficult. And then to put that out there, like these are insecurities that the family has thought of, and now they're putting them out there. So I guess as a creative, like what do you know it, as you mentioned, you're a family man, what do you wrestle with? What do you grapple with? What are your some of your worries?
Yeah, I mean, my worry, like all of us, is that the phone's never going to ring. And I actually, one of the first, in fact, the very first conversation I had with Ben, he didn't know very much about my background, but there was one very similar aspect of our childhoods, and that is that at a fairly significantly different level, but both of my parents were actors. They were both horror movie actors. They met on the set of a movie called Dr. Jekyll and Sister Hyde, where my father turned into a woman and went on killing sprees, murdering prostitutes. My mother played prostitute. That's how they met and fell in love. But I was brought up, and my father did a lot of West End theater, a lot of he did a sitcom in the 80s. And he was someone who just constantly thought it was all going to end at the end of every job. And I think that I, to some extent, have inherited that same anxiety. It's a little bit different in music because for us, I feel like we can go and do something else, whereas an actor is really the slave to the agent and the writer and the director and a million other people that feed you the business. And I think that that's something that maybe Ben kind of could relate to some extent. His parents obviously became very successful early on, but that as you know from the movie, that first part of their career was very touch and go. And my father died when I was a teenager, and after he died, my mother and I discovered all these like he wanted to be a HV, wait, what was it? Heavy goods vehicle, HGV. He wanted to be a truck driver at one point. He's like, that's it, I'm done. Don't want to be an actor anymore. And he got like an HGV license. He wanted to be a Mandarin like translator because he was very good with the language. He was half French. Constantly just like, that's it, never again. I'm not going on the bloody stage anymore. It's just like, I don't know. I can't really relate to that because I feel like I'm not good at anything else. And like I said, with music, you can always like go and make a record with someone or whatever. There's always a plan B, I feel like. But that kind of pressure, yeah, it's definitely there. I think in any kind of entertainment scenario, my children still think of what I do as like daddy's crazy noises and, when they were very little, I'd have them here and I'd be like, composing away, but it just becomes like any other parent after a while. It's just like, oh, yeah, all right. Dad, I'm bored. Like my kids will sit over there on a Saturday and I'm like plugging a Mellotron into a pedal that's like making cool. Yeah, when are we going to go to the movies? Like, what's going on? So it's all relative, isn't it? So I don't know.
It's charming to hear because I feel that they don't want to, they don't care how the sausage is made, they just want to appreciate the finished product and
I think so in the
stuff.
end. Yeah. I mean, I'm trying to, my father was always like, be a plumber, go and get a proper job. And I feel like, oh my God, I think I'm inheriting that as well. For God's sake, don't go into music. Just
Yeah.
go and be an accountant or welder, something useful. Anyway.
Well, John Powell's father told him to become a plumber because he was not confident in his musical skills. But I think
That's kind of, yeah, same racket. Smile, man.
well, there's another great line. I forget who said it in the movie, but it said, "Anne was the strength of the act," and Stiller and Mira on stage, and on the radio. They worked off each other because of the dynamic between the two. Now, being Will Bates, being a sort of solo composer, let's go back to those tricks you were mentioning earlier. I think one of the ways to stay relevant and be the strength of your own act is navigating courses and being able to, roll with the punches and fall on your sword, so to speak. So I'm wondering, are there things you have learned, ways to sort of compose yourself or ways to sort of put up your armor when dealing with certain situations? Is there anything that you know now that if you went back to young Will and say, hey, this is going to benefit you later on, so focus on this?
That's interesting. I mean, I think not being precious is probably the biggest lesson that I've had to learn. And, like talking about handing over my stems, like 20 years ago, I'm not sure that I would have been quite so free to do that. And I think sometimes as a composer, you do have to remember that you're at the service of story, and that the story is king. And sometimes you just gotta like remember that and take a step back. And often for me at least, that's, it's a it can be quite a solitary pursuit until you're working with musicians and, finishing a score. But I think one of the things for me is that it's so important to, when you're done with a piece of music, even if you think it's perfect, to just have someone come and take a listen to it. In my case, it's normally my producer Lucy at Fall on Your Sword, or my wife Sarah. In fact, this was a conversation I had with Ben when he first came to my studio. I played him the first batch of stuff, and there's stuff that was great, and then stuff where I'm just like, he didn't even need to say anything. It's just that there's something strange that happens when someone is in a room sitting next to you, and you're able to kind of watch it through their eyes. And then we had a discussion about this, and he's like, I know what you're feeling right now, because honestly, as a director, you're sitting in a room full of 30 people at your first screening, and you're just like, what, no, why did I do that? Like, and it was amazing to hear that from a man like him. It's extraordinary that I guess at every level you still have that weird thing that happens when you experience something that you've made with someone else, and it's just like, oh yeah, that's not right. So I think that's something that I think I could have benefited from sooner, like really trying to sort of experience things from an audience's perspective and not be quite so carried away, because
Sure.
you can get pretty carried away. That sax, for example, probably going to get taken out, but you can but try.
Yeah. Well, there's a phrase I like to use all the time. It's never try, never fail. So,
There you go.
it's
Exactly.
it's
Who
it, my
dares
win
win?
streak is through the roof. But no, going to kind of what you said, there's another. I mean, lines throughout this entire film are, worth. I have so many post-its I'm trying to focus on. There's this one. It says, basically, you put so much good out in the world, but you're only focusing on what didn't work. And when it comes to working with someone to help tell their story, and as you said, you're in service of it. I guess, what did you find as the sort of the point where it came together and you like your jumping off point? I'll just jump to this one. Sullivan was the jumping off point for Stiller and Mira. What was your jumping off point to where you and Ben were like, yep, we found it. Now let's go and percolate.
Totally. That's really funny, because I think it was actually the Ed Sullivan sequence, which has like two parts to it. I don't know if you remember that. There's a very energetic, kind of propulsive, frenetic almost sequence that I used my wonderful drummer Spencer Cohen, who did a really amazing work on it. And then the second half of it is kind of quite internal, and there's a piano melody. And I think that was one of the sequences that they were working on when I came on board. Like, it wasn't quite locked, and they were still trying to figure it out. They hadn't shot that whole thing with Colbert yet. I hope I'm not giving anything away by saying that.
It's
But
all in the
yeah,
past. It's a documentary.
that's true. Yeah, good point. Good point. Yeah, like coming up with that melody that then is quite featured earlier on in the movie. And I think that was a kind of like, oh, that's it, found it. And then the other one was, we called it the Pinnacle Suite, which was sort of the moment where, right after Ed Sullivan, they started to tour, and suddenly their act went from being this kind of New York City, Lower East Side thing, to being Las Vegas, and like playing in like larger venues and stuff. And it's seeing them on tour, seeing the kids going with them. And then thematically, there was a piece of music that I wrote for that. And it was Jeff Richman, who works with Adam, the editor, who was like, could you take that piece of music and just make it like 5 minutes long? Just go for it. Don't worry about picture. And so I did that. It was a really great exercise. And it was really helpful that he kind of pinpointed it, was like, that's got the melody that we're looking for. Like, let's use that. So there's like three or four melodies that come back throughout the movie. And I feel like those are the two that were earliest to kind of come together. And sometimes, it takes someone else to pinpoint it, which is cool. Jeff's really good at that stuff, really good editor with music.
Well, n not even speaking about editing, let's go back to what you were saying about mindset, about how dropping certain melodies in the beginning can help, form the theme over time. I go back and forth with this because you think I remember speaking to Michael Price about Sherlock, and he was saying something, and I asked him, I was like, what's the importance of an intro theme, like a TV show? You want to hit somebody over the head with the theme, and then this is it, then you're off to the races. And then similarly, Michael Giacchino says something like with Star Trek, they needed to earn their theme at the end. And then Lauren Bolf says something to the effect of, well, you hammer home the theme in the beginning, and then you can sort of deconstruct it throughout the film. And I understand, like Snowflake, there's no one way to do it, but kind of like you were saying before, you kind of evolve it over time. And I'm just, does it change from project to project? Is it a personal thing? Like, how do you physically like to work, Will?
I think it changes from project to project, but there's always, for me, there's always the same thing at the very beginning, which is just this feeling of, I call it a kind of eureka moment where I'm responding to a character or a page in a script or even a piece of visual footage, and I'm behind the piano or playing with whatever, and I stumble on the thing and the melody or the chord sequence, and it's like, oh, thank God I found it. It's like that couldn't exist without that, like one is inherently linked to the other. And I think that sometimes that is a melody and sometimes it is a chord sequence, and that's therein is, lies the difference. And some filmmakers are not afraid but are resistant to melody, and it's like maybe not necessary and it's not in the style of filmmaking that would make sense. And then others are very drawn to it, and I can live in both worlds, and I'm sort of happy doing so. I think it's quite unusual for documentary to have like a theme like this, which I was really happy about in a way. And again, it kind of goes back to what Ben was saying at the beginning, and also the kind of filmmaker that he is. Like he's a, I don't want to say traditional, but he's a Hollywood filmmaker. It's like he understands the power of music and melody, and wasn't afraid to kind of go there, I guess. But yeah, I think the way that you treat it completely depends on the project. And again, it doesn't have to be a kind of hummable piece of music, but I've always been drawn to those. I'm got into this racket falling in love with John Williams and Morricone, and those guys aren't atmospheric. They're not tonal composers. Those are tunesmiths. I at least I think of them that way. So I love a good tune.
It's something to hum to yourself as you're walking the halls or riding the
Right.
elevator, four bars, 17 beats, whatever. Well,
Yep.
perception is reality, Will. You're a musician, you got great hair, you seem like you know what you're doing, everything works out well. Like, what is the trial and error process for you? Do you know when you said you learn that things aren't precious, you sound like you're okay to jettison ideas, but like
That's right.
Let us into your chocolate factory. Is there so much chaos happening, or do you just kind of like, hey, it's island time, man. I'll find it.
No, I the beginning of a job starts with me freaking out, panicking, yelling at everyone around me that basically that's it. John Williams took the last melody. There are none left in the universe. That's it. I might as well just go home. And then, I get working, and then it always happens, and I always find it. Sometimes it'll happen immediately, and it's kind of weird. And then sometimes it'll take a minute, but it always does in the end. And I think one thing that I have learned is I'm very good at sort of stumbling around in the dark and not knowing what I'm doing in a way, if that makes sense. Like My studio is set up to encourage accidents, and make sure that things are instantly capturable in those moments. And because I'm very impulsive in the studio, and I'm also very impatient and want everything to work, so everything is always on. I guess you can't see, but like I'm surrounded by things and wires and stuff, but I know exactly which input goes where, and I can access everything at any moment and send things to different places and create what I call a kind of soup of sound that I'm then able to draw my melodies from. But yeah, I think that chance is like a huge part of the way that I operate. I don't have a template. I just hit Apple N, you know, it's like a blank piece of paper, which is also like, you know, strangely terrifying, but within 15 minutes it's chaos, as my assistant will testify. Sorry, Eric, but yeah, he's the one that has to like clean everything up after I'm done making a mess, putting my toys away. But yeah, that I think that it sounds like mayhem and chaos, but then it becomes very disciplined after that. Like that first set of sketches, that first kind of stumbling around moment is quickly replaced with experience, I guess. And I know when there's something special, and I can grab it and turn it into a piece of music that would actually work up to picture and can be taken by an editor and can be stemmed out, and then we can take melodies from it and, you know, adapt it into different contexts. But yeah, I think that's something that has come with experience. Like I don't really want to walk into a studio knowing exactly what I'm going to do. I will, of course, have like general ideas of what instrument I'm going to lean in into at the beginning of something, but I think not having a plan has helped me like in the long run, and it keeps it interesting and exciting.
Well, I like that because in a way it ties to something that was in the film where it said, let's see, Jerry rehearsed morning, noon, and night. He struggled over every sentence because you want your delivery to land. But the thing that I'm kind of curious about as someone, as a consumer, you know, what comes through my ears when you're working, it sounds like the beginning of a project is hectic. But is it scarier to come up with an idea, or is it scarier to sort of land and find an eventual sort of stopping point? And what I mean by that, it's like, you know, you get your idea, you're like, you're so caught up in the moment, and you're like, it has to end here. Crap, it kind of goes back to what we were saying before about the truncating of something, like.
Sure. I think that's something that I've got really good at, like knowing, like being able to fit the circle into the square, you know,
Okay.
and that's I really enjoy that as well. And I also, you know, it's also something to, you know, working on a movie is one thing, working on a TV show or whatever, where you can kind of take those melodies and sort of do the breadcrumb thing. I get like very into the math of it all. Like, well, what if we took this theme, turned it upside down, have it played over there? You know, no one is ever going to notice, but I will, and it's very satisfying. And I think that's exciting, and I love that aspect of it. I think the worst, the scary part is the bit right before where it's kind of like, what if I don't find it, but I just do. And I think that's also, I'm better at like the panic now. It's not scary, because I also have an incredible family who are also like have witnessed this more or less constant neuroses of like, ah, that's it. And they're very supportive, you know. My kids and my wife are like, no, just go back to work, I'll do the dishes. Just go and find it. And like an hour later, I found it. Yeah. We knew you would, you know. So it's helpful to have a system around you that can support that kind of craziness, because it does get a bit crazy.
Well, I guess that's why you're one of the few, if not only, composers out there who has a mustache and a goatee. You're probably just walking around the house like,
Is it a
yeah,
goatee?
life is cool.
God.
I'm like a Fonzie
I'm gonna shave.
over
That's it. This actually started as a joke, as most things in my life do. It started as a joke, and then I got kind of used to it. And now my daughter is like, I'm going to leave home if you get rid of it. So,
Oh, that's very nuclear. I shaved my face one time, and my daughter goes, "You need to grow it back." And I go, "What part?" And she goes, All of it.
All of it. That's good. That's really funny.
Well, talk to me one more thing before we head out. I think let's see. There's another line in the movie. Again, I'm all about notes. You only have one chance to do these jokes, so don't fuck it up. That's just like the, you know. But I feel like there's a bit of a safety blanket with music, you know, because you can craft it and fine-tune it. And it's just like rehearsing jokes. I feel like, you know, what is the, how do I say this? What is the pressure that artists put on themselves to land something when really it can find time to evolve over time or, you know, have layers and, you know, maybe be different on a different night? I don't even know if
That's
that
true.
question makes sense, but.
I think I get it. I think the difference really with what we do is that, you know, of course I'm performing and it needs to be captured, but I'm not like, it's not quite as spontaneous and spur of the moment as a performance, as a stand-up comedian. Or my father always used to say like boxers and stand-up comics are just the bravest people in the world. You know, it's all based on the here and now and the immediacy of performance. And like, you know, what we do, I can perfect it. There is always that same thing of like playing it to the person who's paying you or playing it to an audience and feeling like it's not ready or crossing your fingers that they're not going to have some kind of terrible memory about the tenor saxophone. I'm so convinced. I don't know why I even put it in there this morning. Anyway, but you know, I think it's a different kind of discipline, isn't it? Like being a performer. I came from that world and I was in bands and stuff and had a crack at being a lead singer and it was like rewarding and stuff, but also your whole world can live or die by a good or bad performance at the best or worst time. So yeah, it's a different kind of pressure, I think. It's not for everyone.
Yeah, and that's the thing too. I've heard artists say that work is never finished, it's just abandoned. And, you know, at a certain point, you just have to put the pencils down and turn it in because you'll just keep noodling on it forever. But,
Yeah,
you know,
that's
release
true.
dates and soundtrack printings are their own animal. But all that said, I guess what was Ben pleased with the outcome? You know, how was his reception to his story being told with an acoustic font?
Totally. It was great. And the more I got to know him, the more I respected when it was right, it was wonderful. You know what I mean? Like he's not someone who's like, yeah, it's good. It's like, no, it's not right. You know, and that's, oh, it's so refreshing, honestly, to have that sometimes. Like, you know, part of the thing with scoring to picture and also, you know, just collaborating with someone on music, and music is so abstract. And I can't tell you how many times directors at the beginning of a process will be like, I don't know how to talk about music. It's like, you do, you just, none of us do. Like, I don't know how to do it either. That's the job, is to try and figure it out together. And I always say, like, it's so much better to talk about something than nothing. Like it's the sooner I can get going, the better. And like sketches and you know, respond to instruments and tell me that you love the mellotron, you hate the saxophone, that you love the piano or whatever. And you know, then we can have a conversation. But yeah, with Ben, it was like, you know, it really meant so much when he was like, it's really good, man. I'm like, really? Cool. You know, because it's Ben fucking stellar. It's
Yeah.
amazing.
And it's funny too. Again, I keep trying to use the phrase perception is reality. I think, you know, people always have to put a persona on in front of the screen. And I'm just wondering what that's like behind the scenes. You know, Jim Carrey can be one way, George C. Scott can be one way, but you know, to his kids, to his coworkers, to his artistic collaborators, you know, they're a different person because they're trying to achieve something different, you know? And
Sure. Yeah, I think, you know, he's not. Artists aren't necessarily performing when they're working on this aspect of the job, you know. So he's not, you know, people aren't kind of cracking jokes, and people can be charming and funny and great, but they're not like, it's not like I was sitting in the room with Zoolander, you know. So that would have been good there. That would have been
Wait,
good.
it's inside the computer?
Yeah. Wait, get it out. Yep. Sequel.
Well, Well, I can't wait for the world to check this out on Apple next month, coming this October. Stiller and Mira, Nothing Is Lost, makes a great case for hoarding, but only if those memories mean a lot to you. So Will's music means a lot to us. It was great catching up. Will, why don't you take us out and tell us what else is on your plate and anything that's going on in your world?
I have a show that's coming out today, which is an NCIS offshoot called Tony and Ziva. That's a 10-part series on Paramount. And then I just got back from Telluride, where I had a movie called Tuna, directed by Daniel Roa, starring Leo Woodall and Dustin Hoffman. And that's about to head to TIFF next week. So, yeah,
Oh,
fingers
cool.
crossed and all of that.
Well, we look forward to that. And maybe it's my Texas drawl, misunderstanding a prompt and affectionate UK dialogue. Did you say tuner or tuna, like the fish?
You know, when you see the movie, you'll understand that there is a connection. But yeah, tuner, tuner, meat and booner, tuna.
Welcome to the Deep South, Will Bates.
Yeah,
That's
love it.
great. Awesome. Well, Will, thank you for your time. Everyone, check out Will's work on the air, on your earphones, TV, film festivals. He will stick with you like chewing gum. Will, it's been a pleasure.
To chat with you. Thanks for having me.
Anytime, anytime. And we will catch you next time.